Well, this is very different from what we've heard this morning. This is going to be a talk all the way the opposite extreme of the sublime that we had started out with this morning. To some of you will think of this as the ridiculous. This is the part of the talk of the conference that has to do with high energy density physics and what do you do with a big laser if you're not looking at molecules and doing all the very short time things. What else do you do? Well, I wanted to give you an example of something that many colleagues of mine and my own work, my own students over the last 5-6 years have been working on, and it's serendipitous that it came up, and that's why I titled the talk "Some of the Amazing Things That Happen When You Hit a Piece of Matter with a Very High Intensity Laser," because we certainly didn't expect to see what I'm going to be talking about. Of course, all this work is, you'll see this is a vast amount of work, which I'll be covering relatively quickly, and it can only happen when you've got really very good colleagues all around the world, and led by Mike Key and Andy McKinnon at Lawrence Livermore Labs, my students at both University of California and my colleague Lynn Van Workum, and students at Ohio State, Farhad Beg and his students at UC San Diego, and also incorporated in here, which I don't have the symbol up, is General Atomics, and some very good colleagues that I've got there. Of course, many of the targets that you'll see that we use here are pretty sophisticated, and GA is the world's best maker of targets for things having to do with the kinds of things I'm going to be talking about. And I'm going to try to generalize this into a particular result, which I think what we are finding has enormous applications. So this is an applications talk, folks. This has got the theory is E&M 101. So that's the amount of theory that's in it, and mostly it's applications. And at the very end, you'll see the ultimate application that, of course, drives all of this and is the source of all our funding. But I'll spend most of the time talking about what we consider to be one of the most entertaining applications that we've run across. So with that introduction, let me just start by pointing out here that this is sort of what a messy experiment really looks like. If you take a solid piece of material, usually these targets are measured in microns, up to 100 microns, 200 or 300 microns thick, by millimeters in size. You hit them with a laser. These lasers that we generally use when we're really trying to drive these kinds of behaviors are enormous. They're kilojoule in half a picosecond. They have a Ponder motive energy of 3 times 10 to the 20th or greater. So that is about, I lambda squared. It turns out to be a Ponder motive energy greater than about 5 million electron volts. So the electron is being shaken so violently that its self-energy is greater than 5 million electron volts. We have measured, I won't be talking about it here, but we have measured at the interaction point magnetic fields in excess of 10 megagauss, and electric fields that get generated during the course of the pulse at surfaces that are measured in megavolts. Now, what happens, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, although it's an entire subject that we've spent a lot of time on, is how does this energy get converted into electrons that go into the material, and then what happens to all the electrons when they get in there? The mechanism for getting the electrons to go into the material, and what I will be referring to as hot electrons, they are electrons that are relativistic. They are one of the main mechanisms is just the Ponder motive potential. Ponder motive potential shoves these electrons going forward in such a way that you get electron distributions that have equivalent temperatures of 5 MeV or greater. And then what happens, and this is the surprise, and there's a long history of this surprise, and I'll give you at the end of the talk, I'll give you a slide showing you where you can go find all of the original work starting back in about 2000. It was really serendipitous. No one expected it. They were doing these experiments at Livermore, and what they found coming off the back of these targets, virtually any target that you hit, was a very intense forward beam of not only electrons and gamma rays and all the things that you would expect when you've heated this material up to near the temperature of the sun at the first part of the target. But what came off the back of these targets was very intense beams of ions. Protons mostly, because water vapor is on the back of these targets. But we also could put different kinds of materials on the back of these targets, and you just get these streaming ions, just very intense, up to 20, 30, 40 MeV for protons. And this was really very unexpected, but it turns out to have very entertaining characteristics. Just a summary of what happens. Oftentimes, this is the summary slide of a talk I'll give like this, where I'll go through all of them, but I'm not going to spend my time only on ions today. But basically, you get if you hit the piece of material with the kinds of the intensities that I showed you there, you'll get gamma rays that go all the way from, or electrons that go from 1 MeV up to several 10 MeV. Approximately 3% of the laser energy will convert it into these. Electrons, you'll get electrons out of the target that are between 1 and 10 MeV, and you get enormous conversion efficiencies, something that, again, we didn't expect. That is, 40 to 50% of the incoming optical energy is converted into electron energy, kinetic energy, about 40 or 50%. And here's what was surprising, was that beamed off the back of the surface was at an efficiencies of 6%. Now, that's 6% of the laser energy that you put in is converted into protons. And these protons, as I mentioned before, have energies that are, these are protons, 6% in protons have greater than 5 MeV, and they go up to as high as 50 MeV, at least for the lasers that we've used. And during the time that the laser is on, which is half a picosecond, you get a very high flux of protons. This is 3 times 10 to the 13th protons will come out of that target in half a picosecond. You'll see they have very interesting characteristics. I will also point out that we've been working on understanding what is the limitation of that conversion number, and just to say something ahead of before I get there, is that we now believe this number can go as high as 30 or 40%. So it's a really remarkable fact, if you sit and think about it, is that you start with a laser beam, it's all electromagnetic energy, and you'll end up, after hitting this target, of almost 50% of that laser energy is converted into kinetic energy of motion of protons during the course of the event that you're watching. This is just to give you an idea of and I'll speak to it a little more in the next slide, but this is a very quick summary of why it is that protons come off the back. It's a proton acceleration method. This is a very simple picture. A lot of work, a lot of people went into, over the years, into really trying to understand where this comes from, but this is pretty well settled now, that the protons come off the back of the target. The laser accelerates the protons up to the potential energy of the quantum motive energy. A few of the most energetic electrons escape, okay, and when they escape, they leave this target charged. But when they leave the target charged, then they turn around and they come flying back. They're moving at essentially the speed of light. So that they leave the target, they come back, they go through the target, go out the other side, and they essentially set up sheath fields that are separated on the order of fractions of a micron from the surface of the target. That, of course, is just charge neutrality at work. And it's also the fact that these electrons are moving so fast that the Coulomb cross-section for interaction with the target is very low. So so that the electrons go flying back and forth through the target as though the target weren't there. It's, of course, not entirely true. They may go back and forth maybe 10 to 100 times and lose their energy, but for all practical purposes, during the time that the laser beam is on, the electrons are in fact find this just to be free space. Well, you set up a sheath field here, and so this turns out to be a very strong electric field between the sheath field and the surface, and so if there's any positive charges along the surface, they're accelerated by that that sheath field, and they're accelerated off the back. And they can be quite intense. This is a little more detail. I put it up here so that this can appear on the website if you're interested. You can go through it very quickly. The laser suddenly creates a large number of hot, now is a term that we use. Just remember that means relativistic electrons. And so they are approximately equal to their energy is about the quantum motive energy, and the number of hots is the laser energy times efficiency divided by the electric charge. And this turns out to be the number of hots turns out to be, if you take 200 joules and a few MeV, you get several times 10 to the 14th. These fly through back and forth through the target, as I said, setting up this field. And when you just put in the numbers, that the number of electrons that are necessary to make all this happen turns out to be about 10 to the 18th, all of which is you can sum up and convince yourself that you haven't overcounted or created energy. And the sheath field then accelerates the ions off the back. Well, these characteristic of this beam is really remarkable. Now, remind you, this I'm not showing you the slides about how they discovered this and the petawatt, the first petawatt ever built at Livermore, and it's long since taken down. But they spent a lot of time thinking that these were electrons that came off the back. They finally were able to convince themselves that they were protons. But they have some very interesting characteristics, one of which is the proton beam is exactly normal to the back of the surface. So they had all kinds of targets where they would hit this thing at various angles and look at where the protons came, and they always come exactly off the back of the target. They are multi-MeV, and they got a quasi-Boltzmann temperature distribution, tens of MeV peak proton energy. And the proton beam, and this is the part that I'm going to be talking about, why we're so interested in it for applications, is that it's extremely highly collimated. It looks like it comes from a point source if you take this back. So its brightness is very high. And in fact, it turns out that the highest proton energies are confined to the center, and the lower energies are around the side. So the really high energy protons that you would want to use, say, for radiography, or you might want to use in some kind of application, they're really confined in a very pencil beam in the center of this proton beam coming off the back. This is just a... Again, I put this here for you can actually do this. This comes from the paper, which I'll show you in the back, by Steve Hatchett, where this little electromagnetic model with the bias sheaths and the fields, you can calculate everything you need to know to tell you exactly what the fields will be, and that the electric field in megavolts per micron is approximately scales as the 1/2 power of the laser. This is in Hatchett in plasma physics in the year 2000. The proton energy depends strongly on the thickness of the target. If you have a too thick a target, then the peak proton energy drops very quickly. If you have thin targets, and some of the thinnest ones have recently been done by our colleagues at RAL, where they have been using actually down to a micron, and before you get blow through, they are actually getting very high energies, much higher than is shown here, taken off of Titan experiments that Andy McKinnon has done. But you can see that if you make the target much thicker, then the peak energy drops pretty quickly, which says that, of course, my little simple model of the idea that those electrons are flying back and forth and lose no energy in the target isn't exactly correct. It's only approximately correct, and it becomes more and more so as you make the target thickness really thin. So here are some interesting characteristics of it. The source size has been characterized using a rippled foil target. So it has an extremely small emittance. So there's the generator of the proton beam, and we put ripples on the back of that target. Okay, so it's 60 microns thick, and you put ripples on the back of 200 lines per millimeter. And then this is a stack of radiochromic film with pieces of tantalum in between, so you record higher and higher energies the further back you go. But if you then develop those films, you see all the characteristics off the back of the surface of the lines that you put on there. In other words, it's carrying all the information from its source across virtually any distance you want here and any magnification that you'd like to have. This shows you the source size. The source size, as you go up in energy, gets smaller and smaller. The emittance is getting higher and higher for higher energies. So the emittance typically is on the order of 0.1 pi millimeter radian, which is really very small. And it makes it for, you can see, those of you who have ever thought about problems like this, you can see that this is going to make an excellent source for taking images. The flow is highly laminar, and it is capable of taking really interesting pictures. And this, I just want to just introduce you to this, because this is going to be something that I will be showing you applications of. Here's where we've taken the source of the electrons and had them go through a mesh and then onto our recorder. And you can see that you get very, very good reproducibility of the mesh into the radiochromic film. Again, since this is coming from a point source, depending on how far back you put this, you can get almost any magnification that you want. So the conversion efficiency right now is what we have gotten it up to 10%, and I'll talk about how we go higher than that. That's been done on many different lasers. Here is the energy in joules divided by thickness in microns. There's the efficiency for protons greater than 3 MeV, and you can see that there's been on Nova Petawatt, we got up as high as 10%. Right now, there's Titan at 35 joules is right here. And the simulation suggests that we can get this efficiency up much higher, that it's not due to anything intrinsic. It's due to the fact that we basically remove all the protons off the back of the target. It's a pretty expensive way to clean a back of a target, but it does clean up the back of the target. In fact, it moves all of the protons. And calculations, pretty sophisticated calculations that are have both PIC and implicit code in them. Here is, as a function of time, if the laser is on for a fraction of a picosecond, what happens is most of the energy is in the refluxing electrons. You can see out the time of about 5 picoseconds. And it's converting its energy into protons. If you had an infinite supply of protons on the back of, say, a 5-micron aluminum substrate, calculations suggest that you should be able to approach between 50 and 60% of coupling of the hot electron energy into the protons that would be coming off the back. So then the challenge is, and this is now a very current work, we are running this experiment as I speak. My students are at RAL with Farhat Beg and his group at UC San Diego. that we have an assembly which puts CH4 onto the back of the target onto the gold substrate and puts the gold substrate for the laser to hit, and then we look at the spectrometer. It looks as though we're getting right now about just preliminary experiments. This can be as high as 20 to 25%. We'd like to get that up higher, because I'll show you some of the applications. One of the things that, of course, immediately should come to mind is, if you think about it, is that, well, I've told you that these sheath fields form normal to the surface. Well, what happens if you make the surface curve? There's no reason to make the surface just flat. Well, this is kind of tantalizing, because then it would say, well, I could have a laser come in, and then I could do something that would then allow me, say, to focus protons down to a very tight spot. Or I could do something, I begin to be able to direct protons, to be able to have high-energy proton beams go do things that I want based on how I make my target. So that's a typical shadowgram of what one of these bent targets looks like. But here, for example, is where we have taken a street camera and we've looked at the heating on the back of a target, where this is just a flat target and all that's happened is that you're getting no focusing. So you can see that as you get the protons arrive at the target, but they have no focusing. Here we've taken that same target and we've bent it into a hemisphere. And you can see that we're getting very tight focusing of the protons, and this is this false color image, but you can look there that indicates that the heating, and I won't go into this, is a subject of several major papers, that the heating, this proton heating, is a much higher heating than what you would have if you had electrons, because the protons deposit their energy in a very short distance into the target. So we've been able to use hemisphere, this focused protons, to about 50 micron spots. We use a planar foil, and we get hemisphere heating up to 20 EV onto the circuit. Remember, an EV is about, an EV in degrees centigrade is 100,000 or something, so this is approaching a million degrees. We believe that the emittance from the our investigation say that we ought to be able to get a much smaller spot, and I'll talk about that for a minute. And improvements in sheath technology, laser spots seem to improve focusing, so it's good for a scenario which I'll be describing at the end of the talk for fusion energy applications. So we're studying, really basically what we're studying now is how to manipulate this proton beam. So again, a laser comes in, you can have a planar beam that goes out by adjusting the curvature of our target. We can have a collimated beam that will travel a great distance with no dispersion in space, and we have now achieved really very tight focus beams, which we're able to get very intense proton fluxes to less than 50 micron spots, and evidence that we should be able to get down to about 10. This shows a streak XUV images showing a short duration signal. Signature is a signature of isochoric proton heating. Isochoric is a word meaning that the heating goes on before there's any hydrodynamic expansion. Nothing, before it blows up, you're able to heat it up to a very high temperature. And this shows you, this is streaked across this way. And you can see that when it's laser heated, this is what happens. And you can see the thing blowing up. When you use proton heating, you can actually get it to be very hot, and then it blows up nanoseconds later, which is the speed of sound for those targets. This is more detail of the kind of things that we're working on now. This is an X-ray pinhole camera imager of the focusing element. You can see this is where the laser is hit. You're getting a lot of X-rays there. This is the target, and there you're getting very intense X-ray spot. White is saturated, where the protons have heated up the target to a very high temperature. We also use a K-alpha imaging system that we've developed that allows us to look at the number of K-alphas that are produced. K-alphas are good. K-alpha are good surrogate for the number of hot electrons, electrons with greater than 8 kilovolts. We can use that to tell us where our electrons are being deposited. And we have done a lot of studies now of what the sheath field actually looks like. If you really look in detail at it, it's not as planar as the simple model would suggest, because as you might guess, there's a lot of interactions about how these electrons flood this surface, how they're going back and forth, and how they end up producing the sheath fields. We now have pretty good codes that tell us exactly how that would behave, so that we can now design our optics, if you will, our proton optics, to get virtually any characteristic of the proton beam that we're interested in. Here's an example of what it can be used for. This is, I'm sorry about this, this is, was done on my Mac, and you can, some of those pictures you put on a Mac and try to show on a PC, you don't get. But you, this is, think of the picture that I showed you where we had the source of protons, and then we have a mesh, and then onto the radiographic plates. Well, in between, what we had was a wire that we hit with another laser. So, timing everything just right, we get the protons coming through and actually recording the electric field of the plasma of the wire. So you can time these things. You take a, basically, you can take a picture of femtosecond duration of the E fields that are involved in a plasma or an interaction between lasers and the material. And you can do the same thing with magnetic fields. Here's a calculation showing the simulated proton deflection due to magnetic fields that would be surrounding there. And we have quite a bit of study now going on about interpreting and understanding and modeling both the E and B field characteristics. And I think for the first time, we're actually getting a handle, serious physics work down to really, really understanding what is up to now been, at least in my view, kind of a, you hit a piece of material and you take what you get. I think now with this kind of diagnostic, we're really beginning to understand what kind of magnetic and electric fields are there, what their time dependencies are, and how to use them. This is just showing, for example, here's proton probing. It's now being used a lot. This technique, since it was first discovered in 2000, is now been used by many groups in many situations. This shows, here's a 1 nanosecond beam, a 0.6 second nanosecond beam, here's 0.6 nanoseconds with different diameters, and these are different time delays, and you can see how the expansion of the plasma is going on the surface, and these pictures reveal, once you really analyze them, can tell you a great deal about, in fact, really peg down very carefully the total magnetic and electric fields and how they are evolving in time. Another thing you can do with them, just want to show you, they're great they take instantaneous pictures, they're great radiographs. Here is a target that was hit by nanosecond beams coming from six different directions at Rutherford Laboratory. And we purposely, instead of having a perfect explosion, We had one of these beams be less intense, and they used the part of the beam around. You made proton flux go through it, record the protons, and you see the protons are a great radiograph or a picture taker of an environment that was extraordinarily difficult to get any kind of diagnostics on, because you can imagine that you're putting close to 100 kilojoules worth of energy onto that target, and this allows you to see in detail what happens when for timing. Here is a relatively good one where we managed to get all of these beams correctly, with correct energy, the correct time, and you can see that the what started out as a target this size has now collapsed down to a all of that material has been pushed together, and it now has the density about 10 times the density of normal matter. And of course, you can see that where this is all going. If you get this with enough density and enough temperature, this is what fusion is all about. Here's a use that many of my colleagues who are interested in shock physics will use and will use this technique for, is studying how shock propagation goes through materials. So here you have a laser hitting the material that you want to study the shock properties of as you send a shock wave through the material. You can then, coming transversely here, you have a proton beam coming through at any time you want, and you can take a picture, and because of the way the shock disturbs the electromagnetic interface, it bends the proton beam in such a way as that you get a nice picture of what's going on in a shock wave. Again, these are, those of you who aren't in this field, and this is sort of, I guess I'm the afternoon entertainment here, I want to emphasize that these are environments that we really want to be able to understand in depth, because they not only have to do with fusion energy, they really are stars in a box. I mean, we're heating these things up ultimately to the temperatures of a star and the pressures that are here. In fact, Todd Dittmeyer is an expert on exactly this problem of how you of what kind of pressures that these lasers can exert, and so the Hugoniots and the equations of state. Again, this is a technique for now really investigating these. I won't spend any time here other than to say that we're making excellent progress using some of the big codes that do both PIC and fluid simulations that show how all of these things are actually working. These are not small lasers. This is not by any means the biggest of the lasers, but it is Omega will be a much bigger laser than this. How am I doing on time here? All right, I'll finish up real quick. But these, even the laser that we use here, the Titan laser, which is 300 joules and a short pulse, and a long pulse of a kilojoule, these things take up lots of space, take up lots of people and lots of time. So here are the conclusions. I'm not going to go through them again. I've spoken to every one of them. I think that we will be able to take this to a point soon where this will become part of a standard toolbox that will be used in virtually all of the large laser systems around the world for understanding what goes on in detail at the interaction point. And let me jump over this and just say that there are many opportunities, and I'm going to leave this in the talk on the site, because these are really these are the series of papers, starting with the original paper by Richard Snavely, my first student at the University of California when I went there. Sorry to say that he died of a very rare disease last year, but this paper is drawn a great deal of attention. Hatchett's paper is the theory paper that does all of this. Then Andy McKinnon and Prav Patel, and then Martin Borghese from Ireland. These are the big movers in this field, and I recommend these papers to you. And then some of the new improved diagnostics, some of them from our group. Jim King is one of my students, and these papers here will introduce you to where this field is all going. And with that, thank you very much.
Question over here.
At the beginning of your talk, you promised to tell how to get 40% efficiency.
Okay. What we really did by modeling and understanding this whole problem was that we know that there is enough energy in the electron flux. We know that the field is on there long enough. Yet we found we are not getting enough protons that corresponded to the length of time that the field was on and the energy that was being taken away by the protons. What we discovered was that we were pulling all of the available protons off the back. So by covering the back with, say, CH4 or ultimately deuterated ice, that we should be able to get, for example, intense beams of deuterons that could be up to 50% efficient from the laser. No, the maximum that we have published is 12%, and our latest figures that we're just now getting are when we've been using the CH4 are indicating up to 20. On the intensity, the intensity, as long as you're above about 10 to the 19 watts per square centimeter on the target with your laser, you'll get these kinds of efficiencies.
Very impressive results. Rick, one of the exciting applications would be proton cancer therapy. It would need 150, 200 MeV monoenergetic protons. Do you see any prospect for generating them with this technique or with something similar?
Well, we have some developing ideas. We have some ideas that we're not sure we're going to be able to get to 200 MeV, but we think that we can make focused small target metal targets that can actually be inserted. And I can tell you in detail about this. This will be something that our medical school is interested
in.
You do
see some prospect in the
absolutely
direction.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, thanks for all those very interesting results. And I was just wondering, whether you have looked to see what signatures can be found in the time domain on these ion beams that you generate. I guess you're mainly working in the mega to giga attosecond timescale range. but your setup is similar to, I guess, your chairman over here has ideas for a similar irradiation of surfaces to produce actually attosecond pulses. Through a different mechanism, but nonetheless, it's a similar type of surface phenomena. Can you imagine anything like that having a signature on the ions?
Well, I certainly can imagine some of the recent work that has come from RAL by Peter Norris, where they used micron thin targets and using sub 100 femtoseconds, about 35 femtosecond lasers, they were getting pulses that were only on, the proton pulses only on during the length of the laser. So I don't know how far down that goes and what kind of target could lead there. I can imagine getting below a femtosecond in a proton pulse.
I should just comment that what he was referring to of our concepts was electron bunches rather than proton bunches.
No, electrons or protons. I think that the what is amazing and what we really never anticipated when we went into this is that these conversions will go on and they'll follow basically the at least down to the tens of femtoseconds. They'll follow the duration of the and the profile of the laser. Now, it's pure speculation, but it's kind of interesting to think about how short you really could make such a pulse of relativistic protons.
Okay, I have time for one more question here.
Sorry. very interesting, but the key for you is the full model for electron, hot electron production. To have a self-agreement model, you need to show what the how you produce the hot electrons with those part energy. Can you say something about this? Because it was some estimation. At first, I think the very fast electrons production. Then you will have some long explosion or something like this. What you talk, but what electrons? What can I say the model for electrons?
You've asked a question that is very much in the minds of the large community in the world that worries about this at the moment. There is no agreed upon model. No matter how large the computer and how sophisticated the people think they're doing, that accurately, to the degree that I want to have happen, accurately predicts the temperature, the electron temperature, temperature and spatial profile of the electrons at the surface. So there's a great deal of work that really needs to be done. Just fundamental physics work that has always been just kind of swept under the rug, and now that we really want to understand it better for these applications, we're kind of having to go back almost 20 years and take all of those phenomenological papers and apply much more rigorous diagnostics to them, try to understand them, and then put those into the codes.
All right, let's thank the speaker again. The next speaker is Alexander Pukhal, who will talk some more about these very intense type of experiments from more of the theoretical aspects.